Now, first of all, you will never be the most interesting person in the room.
Oh.
Because the former CEO of Uber is there, the current CEO of this is there, Greta is sitting over in a corner, arms, legs crossed, and being angry at people. So how are you going to compete? You can't.
Yeah.
So, and they can't compete either, because all of them are going to be looking across and like, oh my goodness, now Charlize Theron has come in there, I got nothing. So you can never compete. Also, nobody cares about your pitch.
Welcome to season 4 of Go Out and Talk to Strangers. This is Adi. I'm a nomadic architect and the founder of The New Movement, an architectural design studio that designs one-of-a-kind, innovative, and creative projects worldwide, using the built environment as a tool to help people thrive. During my travels, I am constantly meeting incredible people, people who are reshaping the way we live, work, and connect. The reason I started this show is because I want to highlight the ones who are leading the way. This is the place where I host thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and founders of unique projects to share their stories and insights. I want to invite you to be part of the change. If you are looking for something bigger than yourself, if you also feel that we can do better, and standard is simply not good enough, you're in the right place. I hope you'll enjoy today's episode. On today's episode, we're going to dive deep into the world of Anne Davos with Mark Terrell. Mark is a strategist, author, educator, and entrepreneur. His work combines collective intelligence with AI, networks, complex systems, behavioral science, and neuroscience. Mark is the CEO of Orcasy, a consulting firm designing scaling strategies for startups, corporates, and nonprofits. He's also working on AI in action, providing executive workshops and training programs to help supercharge productivity, and is the founder of Anne Davos Community. Previously, Mark co-founded Imaginetic PLC, the pioneer in crowdsourcing and collaborative problem solving for innovation. The World Economic Forum nominated him a technology pioneer and a young global leader. Mark is a professor of global strategy at Halt International Business School. I met Mark about a year ago in an Anne conference in a castle. Just a few moments after meeting him, it was already clear to me that the person who's standing in front of me is a different kind of thinker, one who's not afraid to question how we do things. I am glad to share our conversation with you, and hopefully we can all be a bit more creative and wild in how we do things. Let's begin. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Yeah.
I'd love to see you again, Adi.
It's really lovely to see you again. And hopefully this episode is not going to be too loud with background noises. We're in a community space in Berlin. But we'll do our best to...
It's a lovely space. You've got art, you've got food, all kinds of cool people. But you also have being in the middle of a city, so it's quite hard, unless you're in a basement to do that. And even then, there's probably techno music playing because it is Berlin.
It is Berlin. And an occasional train. So everyone listening, if you hear a train, you're safe. Don't worry about it.
Well, and just imagine that you're sitting next to us. It's even nicer.
Yes, I like that. So Mark, today we're going to talk about a community that you founded called Anne Davos. For those of us who are not familiar with Davos or the genre, can you share a little bit about it and how it all started?
So, Anne Davos is a community. But maybe to understand Anne Davos, we need to understand Davos. And to understand Davos, we need to understand the World Economic Forum.
Mm.
Different layers. So, about 50 years ago, a guy called Klaus Schwab created something which was the European Management Forum, and that became the World Economic Forum. They chose Davos as their place to have their main summer event. It was an annual event, so it started in 1970 or 71, and that was became the World Economic Forum.
Which is located in?
So they're in Geneva, but they've also got offices in San Francisco, New York, and it's kind of a billion-dollar nonprofit. So, and it's convening organization, multi-stakeholder organization. Their strapline is improving the state of the world. And they have stakeholders from investment, fossil fuel companies, countries, media organizations. Pretty much if you were to design an organization to help change the world for good or evil, it would be that.
Mm.
So this event takes place in Davos in Switzerland, and it really is, to give you an idea, it's 1 week in Switzerland. It's a very small town, so there's a road up that way and a road down that way. And the World Economic Forum invites about 2,700 people to attend as their guests. Well, when I say invite and guests, it's about a 30,000 Swiss franc ticket if you're a business, if you're allowed to have a ticket. And you can only be allowed to have a ticket if you're a member. And WEF membership these days in 23 is 250,000 per year and up.
Wow.
So it's a good 300,000 investment to go to Davos for the World Economic Forum people. Now, the World Economic Forum over the years, they realized about 15, 20 years ago that they had a problem about representation. So if you have an event where people are spending tens of thousands to be there, clearly you're not going to represent the world. Clearly there's going to be large portions of society that will be drastically underrepresented and totally ignored, therefore. The first way that they decided to sort of handle that was they created a group called Global Leaders of Tomorrow, which was a group of below 40s, a lot of tech people. Well, these people were invited to Davos, provided young energy. However, they self-organized their own event, and Klaus Schwab got very angry and he closed the Global Leaders of Tomorrow down. So they all got basically disbanded. However, the future is young, and a lot of the billionaires of the world are all really young people. So the need to bring youth into the World Economic Forum, which was fundamentally at the age, and still is mostly, although it gets better over time, a bunch of old white men.
And they do what when they go there?
Well, they do... So when he created this young global leader thing, but we'll get back to that. But I mean, okay. What do people do at the World Economic Forum? Well, everybody is rational. So this is the first thing. So nobody is spending 30,000 for a ticket, maybe 50,000 for a chalet, cheap chalet, because they're idiots and they just think, oh, I'll do something stupid and random. They would never do that.
Yeah.
So the way to think of Davos is that for anybody coming for any reason, they always need to get at least three times the return.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you spend. So if you spend 100,000, you need to see at least 300,000 back, at least for your level of confidence. And if you spend 1,000, because you've gone to Switzerland for a day, gone in for a day and done a day trip, just Switzerland's very expensive, it's got to be worth three times that. Otherwise, you wouldn't come because people are rational. There are better places to have a party. There are other panel sessions. In fact, for every topic or theme, there's a better conference in the world. However, if you look at, let's say, per square kilometer, the number of extremely influential, powerful people across government, across media, across tech, across industry, every area of investment, family offices, you name it, they're all there. And because there's only one road in and one road out, they're all trapped for a week. Unlike, let's say, the United Nations General Assembly, which is in New York. And you're just New York, and you take 10 minutes and you can basically be underground in Gotham. So what it means then is that you have this, people would pay to go to join the World Economic Forum. They would then join the conversation at Davos, fundamentally because most of them are paying, they need to get business done. But then there was also, even from the beginning, let's say a decent mission to say, we should improve the state of the world, we should do something. In addition to that, this is my personal view, I actually realized that the World Economic Forum itself is an evil organization, but for a very boring reason. They're evil because they've made it very cheap to become celebrated and famous for doing almost nothing. Because it's a lobbying organization. So what does this now mean? I mean, if you take, let's say, shipping, there are 16 container ships, the biggest ships in the world. They produce as much air pollution as all of the vehicles in Europe. 16 ships. You know who owns them and where they are at any one time. So right now, it would cost about $50 million per ship to fix them. And that would have them have a different type of fuel, and the fuel will be less polluting forever. But here's the thing. What's going to be cheaper? Spending $750 million to fix the problem, or being a member of the World Economic Forum, maybe paying an extra $500,000 to get Bain or McKinsey to write a report on sustainable maritime development, where in 2 years' time you'll get everybody applauding you and the newspapers write about this incredible initiative on sustainable maritime development with here is the best company. And the conclusion is that we need to do more. My question is, what's cheaper, giving the WEF a couple of $1 million or spending $750 million to fix it? And what the WEF has done is a business model, and it's quite sort of, it's done with knowledge, is that they've made it very cheap for companies to get away without doing things that they should do or could do. But that's just a part of the thing. The thing is, though, almost anything you want, you're sort of doing as a project, you'll be able to find the right people in Davos. But that gives you the World Economic Forum. The thing then is that the World Economic Forum created this group called Young Global Leaders, and I'm one of those Young Global Leaders as well, although I'm expired and I'm an alumni with a small A, which means I don't pay the forum. As a Young Global Leader then, we were the replacements to the Young Global Leaders of tomorrow, and we were told don't self-organise. And despite the YGRs having some exceptional people, they just said, you know what, I'm so pleased to be here, we won't self-organise. And so the YGLs pretty much for the first 4 or 5 years didn't do any real self-organizing. A bunch of YGLs did organize their own hotel in Davos. It was very revolutionary. And they would sometimes go off script and say the wrong thing. Well, I went to Davos myself in 2008, and I wasn't a Young Global Leader. I was a thing called Technology Pioneers. And as a technology pioneer, like at the time, there were about 30 companies every year get nominated. And for me, this was a great honor. But so I was able to go there as a World Economic Forum member. So I was in the cheap tickets, which meant that my total WEF funding was $20,000 to be there. Another $10,000 accommodation.
Yeah, such a bargain.
It was a bargain, total bargain.
It is.
and how do I know it was a bargain? In all honesty, is because I immediately signed up to go there again the next year. Why? Because I was selling software and my average revenue per customer was $110,000 per year. So I just get one customer, that's fine.
Yeah.
So it would be irrational for me not to go there if I could. The thing, though, is that if you're a technology pioneer, you only would get invites twice, and then you're not invited again. If you're a company, so there's certain policies now where you get invited for one year. If you want to come back, it's $250 plus the $30,000, remember.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, there are a lot of people that would love to go. They've been once. They'd love to come back, but they couldn't go back again. Well, I discovered that there was a whole world of basically Davos hacking, which I had not invented. And so how did I know that? Well, already I was at the Bain CEO breakfast in one of the hotels where the CEO of Nestle, I think, was speaking. And they had maybe 50 invited CEOs, four heads of strategy that were former Bain consultants, that kind of stuff. And they were basically doing an event parallel to the World Economic Forum. There was the McKinsey party. Very, very famous party. So it turns out that the first people to hack Davos were actually consulting firms, banks, advisory firms, and they would run events parallel to the World Economic Forum in a few of the hotels. Well, this then had become kind of organized, and then the World Economic Forum was first of all angry with those consulting firms, but then they realized it was a money-making opportunity and they brought them into the fold. So then the side event world was basically official side events. But then I kept meeting a bunch of Swissies, lovely Swiss people, brilliant people. I just friendly called them the Swissies. Good Swiss. So, and they were really lovely people, and they were bankers, accountants, and lawyers. And they would be at the same events as me for the breakfast, lunch. I would never see them in the conference, in the convention center, but I would see them at the side events. And they would have a badge. Well, the World Economic Forum had really populated this caste system of what color is your badge, because this shows how important you are. Oh, I'm sorry, you're just a white badge. I'm a silver badge. You suck. Anyway. Aww. Or spouse badges. What's your name? Addy. But you don't have a company listed. You must be a spouse. Sick. Plus, also, the badges basically sit nicely between people's breasts. You had no ability to put them anywhere else.
Of course.
It was creepy. But then there were these, equally creepy hotel badges, but these were, the Swiss people told me, well, they'd been invited to an event at one of the secure, high-level security hotels, and they had a hotel badge. Oh, that's cool. How do I get that? Secret. You have to be invited. Okay. So, basically, the secret was almost nothing. I found out the secret, which is, I mean, you could even just turn up to the hotel back in those days, we're going back to 2011, with a copy of your passport and 50 Swiss francs and say, can I have a badge? And they said, sure.
Really?
Because it was nothing to do with the World Economic Forum. Mm. The hotels have a right to make money. And the hotel said, we have a conference space. These people want to run events. We'll have events. And the only reason why we even have any security is because we're a sort of top-end hotel. And if we have any guests staying, we take a copy of their passport. Well, we'll basically treat this as the same thing. We'll just have a copy of the passport to hand over to the police just in case. So as soon as I found that that was the secret, the next secret was, well, where do you have a place to stay? Well, that was then also shared apartments. A whole bunch of logics around that, because you need a place to stay and then something to do, then came up. Well, my first year in 2011, I was only one of six people outside of this WEF strategic partner, conference hackers. There were about six conference hackers like me. Mm-hmm. And I was the sixth. And I was told by the other five, don't tell anybody the secret. Mm-hmm. We have a good thing going. So we can all go as the six people. Maybe you have a seventh, one other person you can bring, but don't tell anybody else. Because we can make a lot of money out of this thing, because we have the secret. Well, I have a different mission in life. So talk about that in maybe another moment or another occasion.
I want to get to your mission, but we'll just cover the basics now.
So what then happened was that I then told a select group of friends. So then the next year, there were about 15 people coming in, extras. Mm. Well, those people would tell other people. These were all young global leaders. Then I began to have lots of phone calls because I knew the secret. So then I would get, 30-minute, one-hour phone calls with each person telling them how to do Davos.
Yeah.
And they loved it, but it meant that I spent 30 hours on phone calls. I didn't get any money for it. I mean, I had to drop what I was doing just to help, which I would do, quite happy to do that. But I would then forget things. Mm. Or So in the end, I ended up writing a Google Doc, like handy tips for doing Davos.
Mm.
And then, for a variety of reasons, I persuaded, if you remember, I said the global leaders of tomorrow had been disbanded because they self-organized.
Mm-hmm.
For a variety of reasons, not me specifically, but somebody else created a Facebook group, not me. And in that Facebook group, when it was set up overnight, there were about 700 young global leaders in this Facebook group. Well, that meant, and also the World Economic Forum would then said, no, you can't do that. And then there's like, oh, we're very suspicious because we're not invited. And then I said, no, we want you in, come in. And then they didn't realize they got hijacked. Because what they would do is that they would have secrets that they would share to individuals, but they wouldn't share to everybody. So anyway, I decided that, because I was just fed up with having to do all of these phone calls, and I have a 25-year plan to change the world and other stuff, I then shared my Google Doc, in this group, where 750 people looked at it instantly. The World Economic Forum freaked out, and they sent a letter now to 1,200 young global leaders, all of them, the ones who weren't even on Facebook, to say, do not use Mark's special method of sneaking into Davos. Well, to be really successful before the age of 40, it either means you're from a family, or you're a corporate. But even then, you've done some pretty cool and awesome stuff. And you're not just going to say, oh, don't do what you're do what you're told. So instead of it going down to whatever, five people and going to zero, that year it ended up being, I think, 120.
Mm.
And from that, it's grown and grown. So UnDavos now is a community of 2,000 people directly in a Telegram group.
Yeah.
Another 3,000 people indirectly that come in, 3,000 people plus. And if we look at this town of Davos, so people say they're going to Davos. Relatively few, only 2,500 go to WEF.
Yeah.
Another 1,000 go to the WEF partner events. So the WEF world is only around 4,000 max.
Yeah.
And another 16,000 people go during that week to the other stuff. And welcome to the world of UnDavos.
Wow. Welcome to the world of UnDavos. And what people do there? Like, I honestly, generally curious to know, because like you go there and then there are all those important people and business opportunities, but you know, in such a busy setting, sometimes it's hard to have a real conversation or to have, like, how does it look like a day there?
Well, I'll give you a day off, but what tends to happen is that the first year is massively overwhelming.
Mm.
I mean, it's like being in the front cover of a magazine, but you're just talking to the person that's being interviewed every half day. It's intense. The second you go there is equally intense, but for a completely different set of reasons. By the third year, you kind of know how it works. To give you an idea, so a typical day for me. So if I think of, this was like a Tuesday in Davos, 22. I wake up, it's 7:20. I've gone to bed at 2:30 the previous night, but I still wake up at 7:15 because I want to get into the shower because I'm in a shared apartment with seven other people. And if I can get into the shower between 7:15 and 7:22, then I can make my meeting, which I need to be at for 7:45. So I manage to get into the shower. So I have to wait, knock on the door because somebody's, whatever, texting stuff on the toilet. No. So get my shower done. 7:40, I'm out the door, and I paid, let's say, extra money to sleep on a mattress. But this mattress has the benefit of only being 5 minutes walk from the action. Totally worth 3,000, just to get an idea of what. So as I'm there, I'm walking up with a guy basically sleeping next to me. Well, he's a venture capitalist from Armenia. He invests in deep tech AI. This goes back to 22. And we're talking about making investments, his portfolio companies, some of the stuff, help that he needs. And we agree that we should do something together in Armenia and other stuff. About now 7:50, I'm running about 5 minutes late. I go through the security line. I already see one of my friends who's the treasurer of the Africa Development Bank. He's in the queue waiting to go in. We say hi, but I scurry downstairs. Right now, I see at this conference that I'm going to, the CEO of Lufthansa is being checked in because he's a speaker. A woman from DHL, a very senior lady, she was coming in as well. Another speaker. I meet my buddies from Deutsche Telekom. Well, at the moment, we haven't even hit 7:53. It's like that until 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 days in a row. It's insane. If you come to Davos with the right mindset, almost everything is possible because the people are in the room. You just have to do it properly.
Interesting.
Would you like to know how to do it properly?
What?
Would you like to know how to do it properly?
Yes, please.
So we'll role play then a typical, so the best way of doing Davos and networking in Davos. Now, first of all, you will never be the most interesting person in the room. Because the former CEO of Uber is there, the current CEO of this is there, Greta is sitting over in a corner, arms, legs crossed, and being angry at people. So how are you going to compete? You can't.
Yeah.
So, and they can't compete either, because all of them are going to be looking across and like, oh my goodness, now Charlize Theron has come in there, I got nothing. So you can never compete. Also, nobody cares about your pitch. But some people might. So then the game of Davos is to say, ah, interesting, Addy, what brings you to Davos? And you would then say, I'm here to do A, B, and C. And I go, ah, interesting. The guy that I'm sleeping next to in my apartment, he does C. So you and he should talk. I should definitely connect you together. Well, I do E, F, and G. And you go, that's amazing. I was planning to work on E right now. One of my friends is a VC investing in E. And he's over there having dinner, having lunch. We'll just go and say hi.
I see.
High quality networking, because then it means that you don't waste anybody's time. It's very, it's extremely effective. And whilst being polite and non-creepy. The old way of doing Davos is that they would stare at your chest, and then they would, I'm not staring at your chest right now, just for the sake of the podcast, but I'm looking into your eyes, but stare at your chest. They were then saying, aha, interesting. Where's your accent from? Because they'd find out, okay, you seem to have a boring company, and they look over it because they're looking for the next person.
Yeah.
Or some of them, particularly the older ones, would actually then lean up, take your badge, read it, and then just wander off.
Horrible,
extremely transactional networking.
That sounds horrible.
So what's happened is Davos networking has been more of a... Davos networking has become much more of a humanized experience.
So just the fact that people are there create that level of trust. It means that someone put a lot of resources or has the right connections to be in that room, and that's already created something that is worth connecting to.
It's the one that, so Davos in 2008 was a very different animal from Davos in 2018 onwards. So when I was in Davos 2008 and 2009 as a WEF, it was extremely transactional. So it wasn't human. It was very macho. I mean, it was then 92% men. And it was, I mean, it just wasn't very nice. Now, the WEF did some things over time to bring more nonprofits in, younger generation people in as well. They've also sort of forced through more women coming. So at least that helps just to balance out the world. But what's really happened is that this un-Davos sort of rule kit, so it's been looked at thousands and thousands of times. Even the people that go to the WEF doesn't tell them how to do Davos. Un-Davos and My Handy Tips tells them how to do Davos.
Do you keep track of that?
I mean, I have done over time, but there's no need to look at it in any way obsessively. It's thousands of people. Well, and, but I give you an example. So I was asked in 2015 to write an article about being in Davos. I wrote a list of my 10 tips for doing Davos. One of them I thought about, but I added to the list, partially to see if it would work. So one of the things is that if you have a limousine and you're driving and you have a space in your car and you see somebody walking through the snow, stop and see if they need a ride, because that's what all the cool people do. Well, this had actually happened to me twice. So right now I stuck this thing in. Amazingly, within 2 days of the article coming out, I had about 30 people personally come up to me to say, you know what, Mark, it's totally true. I mean, I read it on the list. I was really surprised. And then another guy said, well, I got my driver to go around in my limousine just to pick people up because I'm paying for him anyway. Well, they never would have done this beforehand. And that's because my sort of rule set that I'm trying to get people to follow is share things and help others. And it turns out to do Davos outside of the World Economic Forum, the only way of doing it is to share things and help others.
That's beautiful. And that brings us back to your mission. So you have this 25-year plan of changing the world for better.
Correct.
How would you describe it for someone who's hearing it for the first time?
So, first of all, I think all of life is pointless. Variety of reasons, billions of stars that look like our star. The fact that we humans think we're important just shows how stupid we all are. Very few of us are remembered, will be remembered in 1,000 years' time. And many people aren't remembered now, sadly. So, however, even if life is pointless, and I have a background in complex systems and other stuff, you can still give yourself a point, or a point can be given to you. So I decided that my point is to change the entire world for better, all of it at the same time. Ideally without anybody knowing that it's me, because it makes it harder and it fits my personality. So I then gave myself 6 weeks to come up with an actual plan. So there is an actual plan. In fact, I will then stop there and I will tell you what the plan is.
Yes, please.
Because for the first 4 years, I would tell people I have a plan to change the world and they go, oh my God, that's so awesome. And nobody would ask what the plan was. Like, what could be Armageddon?
Well, it's a secret. No.
Well, it isn't even a secret. No, I haven't published it. Nobody looks. But it's not published very well. So the what I realize is that we need to connect the dots at scale. So Davos, as you like, is my little microcosm of the world. Because what does connecting the dots mean? It means that if you look at whatever, have you ever done networking with Americans?
Yeah.
Lovely people. But if you do networking with Americans, you'll be standing in the lunch queue and they go, oh my God, this is amazing. I love meatballs. My meatballs are one of my most favorite foods. Do you like meatballs too? Actually, one, I had meatballs in Italy once. Actually, Italy begins with an I. I is one of my favorite letters. Blah, blah, blah. Whereas go back to Davos networking, I'm here for A, B, C, E, F, G, match. So I realized in going to Davos and just sort of watching people and connecting with people that I realized all of the right people were actually in the room, physical room. They just had the wrong conversations. So then it's a case of how do you then connect the dots at scale? So, because it's not enough to solve one problem, you've got to solve all of the problems. So for me then, this was connect the dots at scale as the fundamental. Then we go into how do you condition people with a different rule set? So it's sort of rule encoding. To do Davos these days, you have to share things and help others. Well, why is that? Because my version of the Ten Commandments has share things and help others at the top of the list. Now, a contrast to the old world, which was help yourself and own things.
Yeah.
But right now, in order to, whatever, sort of ameliorate our planet, and I mean, our planet's literally burning, quite literally burning, and actually you could listen to this any single day and you'll find an example literally today. So right now, we kind of fucked the whole thing up. But right now, we'll need to consume less. We'll need to just live in different ways over time. We're living in a world of AI right now. There's a whole bunch of crazy shit that's going to happen in our world. But generally speaking, if we share things rather than own things, collectively and individually, we're better off. And so, and actually, so I use, so I can switch between being an extrovert and an introvert. Mm. Introvert is my preference. Okay. So I like then watching what's going on. And then I will would have a piece of paper and I would write. So many of my biggest insights, concepts have actually been developed in Davos, going to one of these parties and ignoring everybody and just writing. Because there are things that I observe that basically allow me to very viscerally experience how this world is changing. I'll give a very simple example. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I've been drinking at the Hotel Europe Piano Bar, very famous place, and then afterwards the X Bar. 2 o'clock, I stand outside, I want to get a taxi because I'm staying in Clausters. Well, it turns out back in 2008, there were only 3 taxi cabs working at night. Only 3. Quite, I mean, not even a joke. There were 3 cabs, the Stifler cabs. There are 4 people waiting for taxis and I'm number 4. First person jumps in first cab, drives off, probably to Clausters where he gets charged $150. Second person, same bloody thing. Third person, in all likelihood, same thing. So the 3 people go in the same direction. They've each paid $150. I have to wait for an hour for the taxis to come back because there are only 3 taxis. Mm. So in this old world where we're just possessive, we don't connect together, we're all miserable, arrogant little assholes running around being selfish, everybody has a shitty experience.
Yeah.
Whereas this new world, this Davos world, there's a group called Beds and Rides, and people will quite quickly say, well, I'm going back to Clausters, I'm planning to leave at 4, who wants to come? And then 3 people say, yeah, okay, we'll come as well. So now you've filled up 1 taxi, so it's better for the environment. And then one person says, I'm on expenses, I'll actually pay for the whole thing, it's fine. Or people divide out the thing by 4.
Yeah.
So right now, and then people end up with great conversations, which may end up with being friendships that last for years. So right now, what's a better world? The selfish world, where everybody is worse off, or this sharing world? And the sharing world is better. But that would be, let's say, I would then sit in the corner, I was like, okay, fine, you've just ignored me for the taxi cab, but I want to write this up as an observation. Mm. So yes, to change the world, then we need to change the rules, Kent, so that people just think differently when they're sort of handling hard things, help others, share things, be good, be honest, this kind of stuff. Next thing is everybody exists in networks. So cheerleaders?
No.
Cheerleaders. Like, I mean, in American football, they have cheerleaders.
Yeah. Oh, cheerleaders.
Cheerleaders, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't get it from the
end. So did you know that there is in America, there's Cheer USA, and Cheer USA has 50 state chapters, and there's Cheer USA to work out competitions and everything else. And then do you know that there's an International Federation of Cheerleading in Tokyo, Japan? Because loads of countries have cheerleaders.
Yeah, but there are many movies about that.
Well, and there are movies as well.
Yeah.
But so it means then that we have people that do cheerleading are part of networks of networks of networks of networks. Now, this International Association of Cheer, Federation of Cheerleading, they need to know about, let's say, running an annual conference or running a membership thing. So they're probably members of one or more association of associations. Mm. And network of networks. So I was actually just at the Association World Congress. Imagine a conference about running conferences.
That must exist, no?
It does. It completely exists. One of my friends is invited to, there's the 200 Top Wedding Planners conference. And they have a conference on planning planning weddings. So right now, many people don't see this because most people are idiots or they're so consumed by looking at Snapchat stories and stuff, they're just brainless. But if you stop and think and look, one of the things that you can realize is that everybody exists in multiple networks or associations or communities, often at the same time. Mm. Well, if you're looking to spread a message of change, et cetera, you can do network hacking. Or network jumping. You can share things from one network to another network to another network. This is also part of my master plan.
Interesting.
And so, then you need reference projects where people say, okay, I hear your stuff, but I don't believe that it works. So then I already needed to have some reference projects that I could, first of all, have them as a reference, but then I could use it to test to see if it actually worked. Because otherwise, there are lots of people that have plans to change the world, but most of them are idiots. Now, I could be an idiot too, and I found I am an idiot. I mean, I did spill over a glass of water earlier when I was doing this, and it was next to me. And I knew I'm going to spill it, and I spilled it anyway.
So it's part of the human experience.
Well, that's the... I did actually realise why I'm an idiot at these things.
Mm.
So I was once complained about that I was leaving coffee cups at home in random places. So I asked for 24 hours so I could understand the coffee cup problem. And I realised, as I was thinking, putting the coffee cup at some random table, it is when I am deeply thinking, I am then focus all of my thought on the thought that I'm having, and I completely ignore everything else. Coffee cup, where's my socks are, and all of these things. So then I worked out, okay, if that's the case, can I therefore still remember my coffee cup while I'm thinking? And I realised, no, I can't. Because I'll just get distracted and it doesn't work. So therefore, for the person that was annoyed at the coffee cup, my suggestion was that I can't fix it. If it annoys you, you can make jokes about me leaving a coffee cup on the top of a toilet. That's fine. But pick it up yourself, because I won't know that it's there. But that's about thinking. So I enjoy thinking. Can I remember why I was saying that?
So many things. But I guess we were talking about reference.
And networks and reference projects. So it's then interesting to try to work out, like, can you, it's all very well coming up with ideas that could potentially change the world.
Mm.
Now, there's a philosophy, a school of thought that says you change the world an individual at a time. And there's an even more selfish way that says first you must change yourself. Doesn't really. I mean, quite often it helps with how do you help 50,000 people get fresh water? Because if you're anxious because somebody doesn't like your Instagram posts, really? Fresh water. But there is a belief, and the thing is that technically it is completely true. You change the universe with every breath you make. Or the breaths you don't make also changes the universe. But so the fuck what? Doesn't make any difference. Because we have 8 billion people on the planet and 1.2 billion people don't have fresh water and electricity. And that's just the basic stuff. We're not even talking about opioid crisis, addictions that people have, people not being happy in their job, people, throwing their electric bicycles into rivers, people not recycling their batteries. Loads of bloody stuff.
No, God. No. So which year are we right now from the 25?
So for my 25-year plan, because you might have your own, it started in 2008. Okay. And in fact, the reason why I'm doing Undavos and why Undavos even exists is because of the 25-year plan and is because of my first Davos in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I exist to change the world. I went to Davos. I spent half my time basically in 2008 being this transaction-driven, I've got a software company in front of $7 million software contract. I was quite good at it too. And then the other half of the time is like, oh, I'm Mark, I have a plan to change the world. Do you need any help? I finally agreed on Wednesday evening that I would, with my board of directors, that I would stop doing the change the world stuff. And I would only do selling software. That night, I snuck into an event where Sir Guy Brin was talking about whatever, saving the planet. And he was talking about how he did carbon offsetting to cover his private plane. And how he then flew his private plane over China where they'd bought some forest to offset his private plane. And there was no forest he'd been lied to. Like, what the fuck are you talking about, dude? You're flying a private plane to look to see if your forest don't get killed. Who the fuck are you? It's just nonsense. Anyway, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm then trying to leave, but I can't do because 3 people have taken a taxi. So I have to go. I only go home at 4 o'clock in the morning because of this. Everything, it all ties together. So the next morning I wake up and I say, fine, I will give it one last chance to speak to somebody about changing the world.
Mm.
7 o'clock in the morning, I met a guy called Arthur Mutambara. He was from Zimbabwe. He was in the front of the shuttle. I was at the back. And we exchanged cards. We said, okay, we have to meet at 10 o'clock in the Congress Center. So he met and he said that he was the deputy leader of the opposition party of Zimbabwe, the MDC, 2008. They were going to fight an election. They would win it honestly, but it was guaranteed to be stolen because Zimbabwe is a corrupt democracy run by the nasty bad guy, Robert Mugabe. Mm-hmm. And so his challenge for me, if I wanted to accept, was how do you have a fair count of the vote? Because my background is crowdsourcing, collective intelligence, behavioral science and stuff, figuring things out. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is, how do you have a fair count of the vote? But he said, look, problems are, there's only 3 weeks, there's only, I think, 5 weeks to go, because the election is in March, so therefore we have no time. Second problem, there is no budget, there is no money. And the third problem, if the first two aren't bad enough, is that if anybody finds out what's going on, including his boss, the leader of the opposition, everybody will be murdered.
Oof.
Don't know how many consulting projects you've done where if it goes wrong, everybody is murdered. But it's one of these projects.
Wow.
So I said, look, I have three problems of my own. I don't know where Zimbabwe is. I do now, but I didn't then properly. So I've known nothing about your country. Next thing, I know nothing about elections. I was born in Canada, and legally I've only recently been allowed to vote. Because Canadians expat weren't allowed to vote anywhere. Fine. So because I wasn't resident properly anywhere else. And then the third thing is that I was out till 4 o'clock in the morning because I had no taxi cabs. And I'm probably still drunk. Probably because I'm still partying because it's 10 in the morning. Anyway, let's find out if I can fix it. So being aware that if it goes wrong, everybody is murdered. So together we sat down and in 45 minutes we invented crowdsourced election monitoring. 1,000 people with camera phones stood outside the polling stations. They were given an instruction to take a picture of their local result. They sent those pictures to a website in South Africa, where 10 students, their job was to turn the pictures into a spreadsheet. Mm. And sure enough, within 3 hours, we had a database of 1,000 polling stations, so millions of votes, and could prove to the world that with a database of results, the bad guy was losing. And in the end, the bad guy lost by 50.4%. It changed the outcome of an entire country.
Wow.
That took me less than an hour. That was my first one. By the way, my first question to him was, did I tell you about the 40 million in 4 years?
I think you have, but not episode.
So, I mean, I like numbers. So when I came up with my plan to change the world, to work out if I was crazy, I would operationalize it by saying, I need to impact directly or indirectly 40 million people in 4 years.
Mm.
So that meant that the first question that I asked this guy was, how many people live in Zimbabwe? 13 million. Fantastic. This means that I do 25% of my target with one project if it works. And it did.
And it did.
And the method was then used in Senegal, Nigeria, and a whole bunch of other countries afterwards. Mm-hmm. It was used in Afghanistan. And it really, that project alone did the numbers.
That's incredible.
And that took me an hour. Stupid.
Mark, but not everyone has your fantastic mind. And
so what?
No.
I don't have their minds either.
No, I know. But
I can't make Instagram posts. I think it's stupid. But I'm not very good at making a podcast.
Okay. So just the fact that we gather here and we are recording and we have lovely people listening to us. If you were to give an advice to someone who wants to start a project that has this big vision that maybe is doing it for the first time and wants to create a positive change, as a change maker with quite an impressive record yourself, what would be your advice to them?
So the I actually wrote a book on scaling. So you can find it on Amazon, Scaling Mark Terrell.
Hmm.
But read the book. I mean, knowledge exists to go help you. If you choose that you're not going to use the knowledge, it's your fault.
Hmm.
But your decision doing a project not to use knowledge might impact the 50,000 people who need fresh water because you just did it badly. So, but then from within the scaling thing, I always start off with saying, well, okay, what is your target? And you have target porn. So Y Combinator target porn. I'm going to help 50 billion people in the next 1 year. So it's targets are important. They allow you to work out, is it possible to scale? How can you do that? Then it's a case of working out, but they also then force you to work out, well, what is it you really want? Because many people haven't thought that through. Or they realize, like, I need lots of money. Why do I need that? Well, because I want to do this. Well, why don't you do this then? You need the money. So next one is that I think particularly if you're going to do things that are quite hard, it's not a bad idea to mentally test yourself.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. So during COVID times, which we can barely remember now, I think it was whatever, decades ago. But during COVID times, I found out that I'd accidentally put on about 15 kilos above my normal weight, which wasn't a good experience. But I didn't notice. So I decided that I would set myself a goal of getting rid of all of that weight within 3 months. However, I gave myself 2 days at the beginning to work out, am I mentally capable of doing it? And that was that I set myself a very simple target on the first day, no breakfast, just an espresso. And that doesn't mean to say I can roll into an 11 o'clock at lunchtime and anything else. So can I survive pretty much before 12 o'clock only an espresso? And I could do for 2 days. And the reason was that I'd worked out that discipline was going to be quite important. And if I didn't have discipline to stop myself having cereal, then I don't have the discipline necessary to make substantive change. So, but that also means for those people that want to be change makers, you have to give yourself like little lines in the sand to basically work out who are you, what are you capable of? Particularly then it goes into whatever, working out what your boundaries are. Because a lot of potentially very good entrepreneurs or social change makers, they basically fight themselves. So they will come up with like, oh, I can't do that because of this reason. Maybe that's true. But normally then this idea of whatever, people fighting themselves in their own head, it's a silly idea. Basically, just go do it and see if it works. I do like the idea of then not taking yourself so seriously. I mean, it's nice to be in a crowd of people where you're sharing your oh, I'm a social change maker. I'm doing this. Brilliant. It's nice to get people saying, oh, that's amazing. But like, I mean, this is why Davos is a great leveler. Mm-hmm. And even Bill Gates will be there and will be thinking, God, those three people over there are worth more than me. And my software sucks. We used to.
And what?
And their software sucks. I mean, because Microsoft Windows used to be terrible. So it's the, I mean, so there's more to it. I mean, the other thing is that, I mean, to actually make substantive change at any kind of scale is not, I mean, it can be easy. The thing is that it's not normal, it's not standard, and it requires thought.
Yeah.
And people don't put the work in. And because people don't put the work in, then it doesn't work. So I like to think that thinking is very cheap, execution is extremely expensive. So I think also if you're listening to this, it's worthwhile going back through your plan, working out, does it make sense? And then potentially testing out one or two of the pieces to say, will this piece work? Because if you just said, look, what we need to do is we need to get the United Nations to sign a treaty that will do this. And as soon as we have that, it's all fine. Okay, brilliant. See if you can get a meeting in New York with anybody in the United Nations. Just anybody. Janitor. Just go for it. Mm-hmm. Within a month, can you get that meeting? Because if you can't, your idea isn't going to work. I don't believe that most people have the mental strength to be able to do that, though. But in that case, it's fine. There's 8 billion people on the planet. Who cares about you?
So positive.
The thing is that I mean, for those people that are listening to this, this is going to be a really nice wake-up call and a strength to say, no, I can do this. I will power through. I'm not a moron like Mark. Some of these people were morons. And then, of those people, some of them will do really well and better than they were planning. And other people will say, oh my God, I have a bit of a moron. I should just get a job as a consultant. Which is also fine.
That's amazing. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. I have one last question, but before we get there, where is the best place to connect with you if any of the listeners want to follow up with your interesting thoughts and ideas? And
So I'm fairly Googleable. So I've done lots of talks and stuff, done 4 TEDx things. But then LinkedIn is quite good. Just Mark Terrell, T-U-R-R-E-L-L. And then on Telegram, I'm Mark_Terrell.
Perfect.
I'm Mark Terrell. _person is me, it's a spoof. But I'm just Mark at Mark Terrell on Telegram.
Oh, okay.
That works. Then if you'd like to join Undavos as well, you can always ping Addie and she could forward. Because the Undavos group is entirely curated. So I've curated every one of the 2,000 people in there.
So honored to be part of that group.
That's good to hear that. Yeah. You still haven't been to Davos yet.
Well, we'll see. Maybe this year.
I've planned for 24.
Let's do that. So, last question. It's called the Wild Napkin.
The wild napkin.
Yeah. Okay. And it's a question that I ask all of my guests.
Okay.
So you go into a bar, okay, and you have a couple of drinks and your mind is very free. Maybe you're in Davos. I don't know. And all of a sudden you have the craziest idea. And all you have is a napkin. So you write it down. What does it say?
From the past, because I've done this many, many, many times.
Of course not, but like today, you know, this happens today.
If I was going to write down a napkin today, what would it be? My current idea that I'm quite curious about, that actually probably today's event might even be interesting, is then how do you have more sort of sharing love and connection without the hippy-dippy crazy shit?
Mm.
Because then a lot of people.
Do you have any lead on that and how it would look?
I'm just beginning to. I realize that this was the problem because I've been invited to, by the sound of a very lovely event, really cool, but it's got probably about 60% of the program as hippy dippy crazy shit.
Mm.
And if it was free, then I wouldn't have a problem because then I would just not turn up. But if I'm also expected to spend whatever, 500 euros going to a place where there's 60% hippy dippy crazy shit. By the way, this would be things that you won't believe to be crazy. Some of you are like, you know, your chakras aren't aligned and you wiggle a bit and they're aligned, but I don't know. But just, I'm using my words, my thinking. Sure. But so what it means for, I've been working out, well, how could I then, or either have somebody else to have that, say, a people that are cool people. It's almost like, how do I then add whatever? It's like bring sexiness to Davos. I mean, if I could do this at Davos, it would be fine. Now, I do have my Black Umbrella Society, so I could use that as a method of doing it.
What is that?
This is the secret society.
Oh.
Talking about sex and relationships.
Interesting. Oh my God, Mark, we can go for hours, but we're really out of time. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Everyone joined us today, and until the next time, go out and talk to strangers. Bye-bye.
Ciao.